The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly. Today saying, football, slow down. There's just too much to talk about. Like the Premier League, we haven't seen turn-ups this big since Crouch and Defoe got their laundry muddled. Man City taming Chelsea. Bolton almost beating Man United. And West Brom winning at the Emirates. Were they the biggest upsets of all? Or was it West Ham winning against Spurs? Or Sunderland not beating Liverpool? The pod has a think about all of that and then debates that Sunderland free-kick controversy before moving on to Europe. With the Champions League back this week, there's plenty to talk about. There's the incredible Mainz pulling off their biggest win yet in the Bundesliga. The surprise end in Serie A to the big Roma-Inter clash. And Sid Lowe in Spain. All of that plus your posts in today's Football Weekly. Woof! Upsets galore, team. And what a team it is. Listeners, in today we have Barney Rone.
Hello.
Hi, Barney, who's even now scribbling notes because he cares that much about pop product. Greg Ruffley, a man with a lot to get off his chest.
Yes.
And Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. Also, Paolo Bandini will be joining us later on to bring his expertise to our Serie A roundup. We've got Sid Lowe lined up on the blower and, I believe, a little cameo from Raphael Honigstein. So lucky, lucky pod listeners that you are. Let's begin. I mentioned lots of upsets. Do they come any bigger than West Brom's surprise victory at the Emirates? Sean Ingle.
Well, probably not. If you look at Arsenal's record against the bottom half at home last season, they won all 10 games. And when we were talking about this in the pod on Thursday, we just sort of brushed through it because we thought it was an easy
two
win for
Arsenal. Arsenal had scored an average of 5 goals a game in their last 5 home matches. West Brom hadn't won away in 2 years.
Yes. I think you have to praise West Brom. I was looking at the Opta stats. They made twice as many interceptions around the box as Arsenal, because they were working hard to keep the Gunners out. However, you've got to look at Almunia.
Look at Almunia in a second. First, I want to say, well done, Roberto Di Matteo.
Absolutely.
Well done. How long has he been a manager for?
3 years,
I think. Not even 3 years. And he's in the top six with West Brom.
Absolutely. He worked very hard to stop Arsenal attacking on the flanks. But I thought Arsenal just looked so
lackadaisical. Yeah, we'll get on to Arnold and say, Barney, you will not be silenced.
Well, I wanted to say, well done to Roberto Di Matteo. And it's really nice to see managers going to clubs like Arsenal and being prepared to attack and play nice football, which he does. I remember talking to him when he was at MK Dons, where he was very popular as well. And he's just an incredibly ambitious and very intelligent man. I just wanted to say it's also a really good story for Jerome Thomas, who I also interviewed when he was at QPR on loan. And when there were lots of rumours he was going to go to Real Madrid because it sounds ridiculous, but he was really highly rated at the time. And it's a brilliant story for him. He went there, he was fantastic.
West Brom went with exactly the same attitude as he did as he turned up at Anfield this season as well. When they just attacked from the beginning and really put Liverpool on the back foot. Now, Arsenal, I thought Liverpool's defending has been bad of late, but Arsenal against West Brom. When West Brom were getting crosses into the box, players were turning the backs, just really, really schoolboy stuff, as if the ball was some kind of bomb that was going to explode at any minute. And it did 3 times for them.
Yeah. Nice metaphor. Have you ever spoke to Peter Odden Wingy, Barney?
I've not had that pleasure, but he's obviously had a very good start to the season and he's taken people by surprise. He's been very fast, very mobile. I wonder if people will start to take more notice of him now, and he might not find it as easy. He's also seemed to give him lots of space, and he took advantage of it.
The Tashkent Terror.
Indeed. How old is he? Does anybody know how old he is?
He was born on the 15th of July 1981, so a swift mental calculation reveals...
He's not a young one, is he?
What, 29? Yeah. You're a mind like a steel trap. Anyway, moving on, everyone. Things that aren't like steel traps. Arsenal's defending, Sean. I know you've got a lot to say about this.
What frustrates Arsenal fans is that they've seen this year after year after year. In the summer, everyone knew that Arsenal's goalkeeper was a weak point. Particularly with the financial records being released last year, Arsenal making a £56 million profit. Wenger has called Fabianski world class, which he's praised Almunia, stuck with him. Almunia's not travelling for the game tomorrow in Europe. We don't know whether it's pride or whether there's some knock, but
The thing that's wrong with Arsenal is a cliche. I heard someone on TalkSport the other day talking about it. One of these sort of, you know, what Arsenal are lacking is a bit of English steel in there, you know, right. Sort of leaders, a few English, you know, Tony Adams. But it's probably true, isn't it? I mean, the sort of leaders on the pitch. Well, and
just how important is Fabregas for them now? Is he the equivalent of like Steven Gerrard with Liverpool, that when he's not there, the rest of them go to pieces and he's like the metronome that.
Well, he's their best player and holds everything together.
Definitely. Yeah, it wasn't just the defending that was poor against West Brom, from what I saw. They couldn't actually pass the ball to each other as well, which is equally as bad because they can't hold possession then.
Bizarre thing about Almunia is he's actually, for all his unreliability between the posts, he's saved 5 of the last 6 penalties he's faced. Curious,
That's all well and good, but if you end up conceding penalties and you end up flapping at straightforward shots.
But he's that sort of keeper, isn't he? He's a sort of spiky haired athletic keeper who makes flashy saves but will let you down.
Says a lot though when he made a simple catch at the end of the game and there was ironic cheers. And I think he's, you know, people remember Bobby Mims and people will remember Alan McKnight, or Alan McNightmare as the West Ham fans used to dub him. Decent goalkeepers, they made a few errors and suddenly they become a joke. And I think unfortunately Wenger's got 2 of them.
Two jokes. Nick Greaves posts in quoting Arsenal News Review blog site with a quote in turn from Sanya, who admitted last week Arsenal defenders talk to each other in French unless they have to involve the goalkeeper when they talk in English. What an idiotic way to communicate, says Nick Greaves, so the keeper is informed on a need-to-know basis. Actually, it might not be a bad idea, given who the keeper is. It is extraordinary in the week in which they've announced that $56 million, was it? Profit last year, that they don't seem to have worked out that there is a way of translating that to equity into some form of serviceable keeper.
Well, Wenger's very keen on getting the right amount for a player. He doesn't want to pay over the odds, but it does turn into false economy if you won't pay an extra million for Swartz or whoever.
All right, then. Well, anyway, West Brom top 6, eh? Look out, Europe. Let's move on to that big clash at Eastland. Man City defeating Chelsea, the first big test this for Carlo Ancelotti's side this season, and they failed, Barney Roney. Or did they?
Well, I saw it on television.
And what are you eating? Just
it's a bacon roll.
So. All right then. You brought it up for everyone, did you?
Really early this morning.
Right.
Sorry.
That means you've had extra long time to eat your breakfast before the pod. Had you turned up fresh out of bed, I'd understand.
As Greg Ruffley did. He's still in his pyjamas.
Well, those are actually his cycling shorts.
Yeah, worrying. I still haven't had a shower, so I apologise for the smell. All the listeners.
But
I was going to say that I think a lot of people have found it hard to cope with Chelsea's, the way they attack. Attacking wide areas, the fullbacks bomb on. They've got these very mobile, athletic wide players who've been in good form. But Man City really seemed to deal with it well. They were very rigid. They seemed to only want to counter-attack. They were very disciplined in having lots of players behind the ball. And Chelsea just didn't know how to attack them. And maybe they found a good way of combating Chelsea's biggest strength.
Sean.
Well done to Man City for winning. But to win the league, they're going to have to be a little bit more aggressive when they attack. You know, last season, for example, Chelsea against the bottom 10 teams won 17, only lost 1. Manchester United won 17 matches, but Man City only won 11 against the bottom half.
So this is the point. They beat Chelsea last year, but then went on to not beat Sunderland the next weekend.
Well, exactly. And when Chelsea lost their first game against Man City on December the 5th, they then stayed unbeaten in all competitions for 3 months.
Right.
And, you know, that's what you have to do. In the one,
right.
You know, that's
consistency.
Exactly.
Do you think that post this game that the narrative for Man City is being tailored to fit the result?
Well, absolutely. I thought it was a game that had 0-0 written all over it. Neither keeper had much to do. City defended well, but because City won, we have to then say, well done Vincent Kompany, well done Mancini for his tactics. If it had finished 0-0, or if Chelsea had nicked a goal, we'd all be slating Mancini for those very same tactics. Yeah. Just like we did when Mancini played that way against Spurs towards the end of the season. And Spurs won 1-0 and everyone criticised Mancini.
Let's criticise Ancelotti instead then, because he went and lost, the silly fool. Bizarre substitutions, hey? When you're 1-0 down, you take off Didier Drogba and you stick on Sturridge. And also, bring your 17-year-old as well when you're chasing your biggest game of the season so far. It was a curious move.
Well, it didn't work out. But, I mean, you've got to admire his sense of adventure. I mean, I quite like it personally. If Drogba's having a terrible game, get him off and get Sturridge on, who he clearly rates, which is nice because Sturridge is a talented player and he needs someone to believe in him.
Well, and
against his former club as well. So.
Yeah. 2 defeats in a week. after the Newcastle loss. Interesting how many of the sides that had been defeated in the Carling Cup. I say interesting because it's not that interesting. But anyway, they now face Marseille. Do you envisage a further further blemish on their record?
Well, Marseille won at the weekend against Sochaux. I hope I pronounced that correctly. But Chelsea's record in Europe, especially in the group stages, is immense. And you'd think they would win tomorrow night.
No, Frank Lampard back as well.
They will they?
They might, I think.
Okay. And Marseille lost their opening game, so yes, there you go. Well, listen, finally then, in part one, Icarumba Bolton, Man United.
And you picked it, James, and you were also saying that you'd had a bet on Bolton to win 2-1.
I did.
Which would have won you how much?
Over 300 quid. I was living the dream for about 15
minutes. That's a lot of ice cream.
It is. It, even by today's, in today's economic climate. It certainly was, but well done to Owen Coyle.
I can just say I'm flabbergasted by Bolton that they're just still in the Premier League after all these years. They're a team, I don't know if anybody knows this really, but when they moved from Burnham Park to the Reebok Stadium, half the fans just thought, well, I'm not going to go and watch them again because they've moved to Chorley, which is in Horwich. It's hardly even in Bolton. It's about 8 miles outside. And the story of Bolton is just strange because despite themselves, the fans have turned up and just slagged Megson off and slagged a lot of the managers off over the years and then haven't turned up at all, and they've gone down to like 10,000 average crowds at times and then back up again. And I just think it's quite surprising that they're still where they are, and it must be something to do with the kind of ethos they've got within the squad, because it's certainly not with the fans. The fans aren't optimistic at all when you speak to them. They're strange.
So are they still getting really low attendances even now that Owen Coyle's in charge?
I don't know what the attendance was at the weekend. I'm just talking about last season, and very often when they're in cup matches, just so many fans just decide that they're not going to go and watch them. And there's a lot of, it's a satellite town as well, so there's so many fans who would go and support Manchester United and Man City or even Liverpool, Everton as well. So it's just quite surprising that they're still where they are, and it must be something to do with this mentality they've got within the squads, which the managers have managed to contain.
Very impressive performance for those who did turn up for it.
Yeah, I think I may have got in trouble on the blog for saying that Man United, without Rooney, these days they don't really have any world-class attacking players, whereas even 2 years ago they had Tevez and Ronaldo backing up Berbatov and Rooney. And, I mean, there is definitely something missing there. I mean, do you think that's fair? I mean, by world-class, I would have thought somebody who, the kind of player who Real Madrid or Barcelona are going to break the bank for.
A Tevez or a Ronaldo.
Berbatov is. They're definitely lacking. They could win when they weren't playing that well because they had that excess quality in spades.
But they're still scoring goals. Aren't the real problems at the back?
Well, it's quite possibly, but I mean, you can see goals when you have to try to score goals in a different way. I mean, they could defend very solidly and rely on Ronaldo to win them games in the past.
Yeah. Rio Ferdinand, what's up with him? Wasn't on the bench for the weekend's game? What was the story there?
I just think he's had so many injuries now, hasn't he? That it's almost like they don't know when he's fit or not. So they try to bring him back and then all of a sudden he's out again when there's a twinge in his back or something. It's maybe getting a bit embarrassing to actually keep announcing that Ferdinand's injured again. So it's just easier just to leave him out and not say anything, you know.
Well, they're very keen to avoid embarrassment for players at Manchester United. Of course, Wayne Rooney wearing a sumptuous ice pack on his ankle to explain why he'd been hauled off. I was going to say brought off, but then... on the weekend. And he's not going to be available, is that right, for the game against Valencia? Well, I tell you what, we should hear from Sid Lowe on Valencia, because they are only the team on top of the Liga right now, running away with the early part of the Spanish season. So let's conclude part one there and dial up Dr. Sid for after this.
Hello, James, how are you?
I'm very well, Sid. Welcome to part two of Football Weekly. Have you been enjoying it so far?
I haven't heard it so far.
All right, then.
I will indeed, of course, joined
us for the best bit. I think most listeners would agree. As you tell us...
What's going to happen?
You're going to tell us all about what's been happening in the Liga. Problems for Jose Mourinho, sadly enough. And Valencia back on top after their victory at the weekend, Sid.
Yeah, they beat Sporting Gijón 2-0, and they were very impressive. They were 2-0 up after 10 minutes, and then they just controlled the game. This isn't the same Valencia side it's been for the last few years without Vieira and Silva. They're perhaps a little less creative, although the goal was wonderful, but they're strong. They're very aggressive. They rested players for the weekend. The coach, Unai Emery, was trying to claim that it was nothing to do with Manchester United, but I think we all think that it probably was. They have played in midweek against Atletico, but they look very strong indeed, Valencia. I still don't think they're going to be this season the side that they've been over the last few years, but they've got the raw material, as opposed to the raw ingredients, to I think be a strong side and be a side that will certainly cause Manchester United quite a lot of problems on Wednesday.
All right,
Wednesday.
Where do you think they can hurt United, Sid?
Well, I think because they will make it difficult for United to score. They're defensively reasonably strong, but I think that's really about their midfield rather than their back four. I personally think they've got a slight problem at centre back still. I think they could do with a better centre back than the players they've got, but they keep the ball reasonably well. They've got creativity on both sides of the pitch, and it's not entirely clear how they'll play this year, whether it'll be 4-2-3-1 or an out-and-out 4-4-2, because they played 4-4-2 against Sporting. They played 4-4-2 again for the last 15 or 20 minutes or so against Atletico Madrid, and Emery seems to quite like that idea, but he began the season not wanting to play both of his forwards, Roberto Soldado and Artis Aduriz. I think they might play them both against United. The player that's really standing out at the moment is Juan Mata, who was the, if you like, kind of the third of the three from the Spain squad, and I think of the attacking players. And I think we probably expected him to go in the summer as well. Barcelona were looking at him, but he stayed. He's very quick. He's very skillful. He reads spaces very well. He's a good assist provider, and I think he may well cause problems for Manchester United, either wide on the left or cutting in from the right-hand side.
Interesting. Meantime, Real Madrid warmed up for their clash with Auxerre with a 0-0 draw against Levante, and the papers are beginning to sharpen their knives for Jose Mourinho. Is that right, Sid?
They were rubbish, Real Madrid. Really, really bad. I mean, they after the game, of course, you can imagine that the focus was on some of the misses, and Higuain had a terrible miss. Cristiano Ronaldo missed one that he probably should have put away. The same is true of Angel Di Maria. But the truth is that while Madrid had a lot of shots on goal, it was much more of the same. It's more of what we've seen so far this season. Lots of shots that are largely fairly pointless from a long way out. Lots of the ball, but without ever it looking like they're fully in control. They're not struggling in a sense that they're not conceding chances. They're not looking like they're going to get caught out of the back, but they're just not making things happen, really, Real Madrid. I thought they were very, very poor at the weekend. Mourinho, quite comically, was complaining about the play acting and the defensiveness of Levante. And in particular, he was having a go at Asier Del Orno, who, of course, is the man who learned everything he knows from Jose Mourinho.
So how come they're so bad then, Real Madrid, with all the players they've got and, you know, Champions League winning manager and all that?
Well, Mourinho is putting forward a number of excuses, and some of which I think he's quite right about, some of which, of course, are a response to poor results and needing to divert attention or just simply needing to make excuses for himself. It is true that it's still quite early. It is true that the surface at the Bernabeu, but this is no excuse for the Levante game, is poor. It's true that it's been difficult for them in those terms. It's true that they're getting an awful lot of the ball, and it is also true that defensively they haven't had any problems at all. And Mourinho has been saying that until he gets everything right and the identity of the team right, the most important thing, in fact, the only thing he's really worried about is not conceding goals. Of course, he's now admitted this weekend that he's worried about not scoring them as well, because they've been away to Mallorca, away to Levante. Both of those games, they didn't concede any goals. In neither of those games did they really look like conceding, although there was a couple of half chances against Mallorca. But on neither occasion did they score. He's pointing to just missed chances, and that's something that will come good. I think what he's also doing is he's pointing to something that he was making very clear to Real Madrid during the summer, which is that he wanted a number nine, a powerful goal scoring, but also a kind of receive the ball with a back to goal sort of number nine. And the club didn't buy him because they said they didn't have the money. He's got Higuain and Benzema. And I think what he's basically trying to point out is that these two guys are not the guys that, as he said when he was presented, score two of three chances. They score maybe two of 15. I think that would be a bit unfair, but that's certainly the excuse he's putting forward at the moment.
All right. And meantime, Barcelona did win 3-1 in a bad-tempered game in the Basque capital. Messi might be back for the game against Ruben Kazan.
Messi has travelled. The doctors haven't officially given him the all-clear yet, but there will be a training session in Russia. So he has travelled, so there's a chance that he'll get minutes against Ruben Kazan. Then Barcelona play, obviously, at the weekend as well in La Liga. I think I'm right in saying against Mallorca. So it looks like, you know, missing out on Messi for a couple of games wasn't too much of a problem, because it should have been difficult for them to go to Athletic Bilbao. And by the way, just before anyone picks up on it, Bilbao's not officially the capital of the Basque Country, but that's by the by. And it wasn't... what obviously, the thing that really kind of, if you like, conditioned the game in terms of the attitude of some of the players was the fact that Fernando Amorevieta was sent off for a challenge on Andres Iniesta. I think what we're seeing, and we saw this in midweek with an Espanyol player, Galán, being sent off for a challenge on Cristiano Ronaldo, I think we might be seeing refereeing decisions being conditioned slightly by the hoo-ha over the Messi challenge last weekend. Both of them are slightly studs up. Both of them are slightly lungy challenges. But I would also argue that both of them are probably challenges that maybe a week ago would have only got yellow cards. They both got straight reds. Of course, Fernando Amorebieta could do the excuse that I'm not that sort of player, but he very much is that sort of player. This is a guy who's got 9 red cards in his career now and kicked Leo Messi in the face with his studs, even though Leo Messi was standing up last year.
That's not that impressive in Leo Messi's case, of course, though. Sid, listen, finally...
It was still quite a high leg. It did look like a French chorus line.
Oh, marvellous. Finally, Sid, Hercules, a 2-0 win over Sevilla. Ooh, both goals from David Trezeguet. The Sevilla boss, Antonio Alvarez, getting the chop, replaced by Gregorio Manzano. Tell us more about this Manzano, mysterious Manzano figure, Sid.
Yeah, hypnotist Manzano. Manzano who uses a lot of kind of visualization techniques, hypnotism in the good sense of the word, not the sense of, you know, getting people up on stage and making them do stupid things like eating onions when it should be an apple and stuff like that. Mm. He uses a lot of kind of psychological work with his players. He was the coach that took Mallorca to 5th place last year, incidentally lost their Champions League place to Sevilla on the final day, but he can't take over a Champions League winning team now because Sevilla in the meantime have gone and blown it in the qualifiers of Champions League. Manzano's taken over. I think he's an excellent manager, although Mallorca were all happy when I pointed that out last year. And
perhaps
continuing.
He's just clouded your mind to make you think that.
Maybe he has. There was a watch dangling backwards and forwards in front of my eyes. And they were going backwards and forwards. And yes, you are a very good manager. He is a very good manager. I think Sevilla have really screwed up 2 years running now when they've held on to coaches that they're not convinced by, club coaches that they weren't sure, but both coaches got them into the Champions League and they felt a kind of obligation to stick to them. Plus the fact that both coaches were relatively cheap. Manolo Jimenez last year, Antonio Alvarez this year, and both coaches have not lasted long. In fact, Jimenez lasted even longer than Alvarez. They finally got Gregorio Manzano in, who they were talking about getting in the summer. It looked like a done deal and it didn't happen. Now it has. I think it's an improvement for them. And obviously, we criticise coaches for sacking managers too soon. I would criticise Sevilla for hanging on to two coaches for too long, coaches they didn't truly believe in, and ultimately they ended up sacking anyway.
Amazing. Amazing stuff, Sid. And why you've never had a career as a horse racing commentator, I will never understand.
Or an opera singer.
What?
Or an opera singer.
Why an opera
hold
singer?
Those long sort of notes without...
All right, and...
Have you ever heard me sing... Jesus Christ, my singing is so appalling.
All right,
so,
Sid. What's your karaoke standard?
Well, I try not to go anywhere near... Well, I go into karaoke bars when other people sing.
Right.
But I try not to sing myself. And if I do,
yes.
You have to choose something that's very deep and not really singing, so to disguise the fact that you can't sing.
Old Man River or some sort of rap
number? I remember a few years ago, Mike Flowers Pops did a version of Wonderwall, and it was basically him talking it. I can just about get away with that. But my singing is dreadful.
Sid can do a mean ice baby.
Really? Vanilla Ice?
Oh, I can do it, yeah. That's not singing.
Straight to the point, I'm making. Come with me, Sid, with me. Cooking MC is like a pound of bacon in Barney's sandwich. Yep.
All right, James, stop.
All right, then. Listeners, post in your request.
I'm back with my brand new invention, something. Anyway, let's stop now, please.
No, as listeners will demand more by the medium of posts, and perhaps you'll, the most popular choice from listeners, you'll regale us with on Thursday, perhaps, Sid. What do you think?
Yes, or perhaps I will disappear on Thursday when you try and call and make sure that I don't have to sing live to anyone.
Maybe you two could have a duo.
Duet.
Yeah, kind of Rennie and Renata style, and we could release the single for charity.
That'd be brilliant. Belle and
charity.
Sebastian.
Hey.
Belle and Sebastian aren't a duo.
Could we do Johnny Cash? And Cash and his wife, whose name's just... And June Carter, that would be brilliant. Darling companion. Yeah, that'd be awesome, wouldn't it? No, we wouldn't. Stop it. Stop it now. Sean, don't encourage this, please.
Well, the ideal time for Barney to finish his sandwich now, as we welcome Paolo Bandini Paolo, another big weekend in Italy.
Every weekend's a big weekend in Italy, James.
Yes, indeed so. Tell us about Inter's shock defeat at the Stadio Olimpico to Roma.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose whether you'd use the word shock defeat, I don't know, because this is, after all, the game in the Italian calendar now. Ever since Calciopoli, you know, this is the one team that's vaguely threatened Inter's hegemony. They're the team who's finished second 3 times out of 4 and twice within touching distance the last day. They've contested all but one of the Coppa Italia finals, and you're gesticulating at me excitedly, so I'll let you butt in.
But Inter were top of the table and Roma were second bottom.
Yeah, absolutely. They were, but they'd only played 4 games so far this season. So we have to show a little bit of perspective early in the season. But yeah, I mean, it was still a surprising result. People didn't expect it to go that way.
Expect it to go that way, did you, when it got to 90 minutes and it was still 0-0?
I didn't think it was going to go that way exactly after about 60 minutes, because I'd made the foolish mistake, because I was doing minute-by-minute coverage of the game, of pointing out beforehand that they hadn't drawn 0-0 since 2004. So it looked very much like that was the way it was headed. It wasn't a great game, but it was a fantastic goal in the end. A lovely cross from De Rossi from deep. Vucinic out sprinting about 3 Inter defenders to get his head to the ball right in front of Lucio's boot and put it into the far corner of the net. And it's exactly what Roma needed, which is a jump from somewhere.
Right. It was very much a race, wasn't it, between Vucinic's forehead and Lucio's boot. And thankfully, Vucinic just got there in time.
Yeah, but it wasn't the first race between Lucio's boot and Roma striker's face either, because boot had already won that race once earlier in the game against Borriello, which Lucio, I thought, was very fortunate to escape.
I didn't think he even touched him there. I thought Borriello made a bit of... But that's kind of by the by. For the Italian press, this was very much about the substitutions. Benitez was fine with the draw, so he took off Milito and put on Montari, hardly an attacking change, whereas Claudio Ranieri, under fire Claudio Ranieri, took off Roma talisman Francesco Totti and put on Vucinic, and that was the winning substitution.
I do think people sometimes have very short memories, and I think that Ranieri, of course, made that point during his rant at the press the other day. But last season, during the derby against Lazio, they were losing at half time and Ranieri took off Totti and De Rossi and they won. And yet today in Gazetta, yesterday in Gazetta, of course, with the report, someone wrote, who could imagine that Roma would win this game having taken off captain Totti? I think anyone who's been watching them this season could imagine they'd win a game after taking off Totti. We talked about this last week, and I know there was some adverse reaction on the blog, which
slapped it down, didn't you, Paolo?
It was a slightly aggressively worded post, I guess, from Pucciem, who had used the lazy journalism line, which, as every journalist, I think, I find very tiresome. So I stepped in and tried to counter it with what I thought were a few valid counterpoints. But he doesn't run, and that's the problem. He can be involved in the passing build-up, but he's got no movement about him. He doesn't provide any sort of... I don't know, he doesn't run any edge at that sort of end of the pitch because of it. And that was the difference. You bring on Vucinic, there's a player who does run, and guess what? He managed to run faster than the Inter defenders for that last goal.
Well, Totti ran pretty fast once he'd been substituted. He didn't even stick around for the final whistle or to congratulate his teammates, which from the Roma captain was pretty controversial behaviour.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he was straight off down the tunnel with a face like a slapped arse, and then into the night, and he didn't hang around for the celebrations afterwards. So no Totti, but very much a party in the end. But I think it's a big game for Benitez, though, because Benitez has basically, ever since he got there, been trying to make the point that he's not Jose Mourinho. And every time he has an opportunity to do something that Jose Mourinho doesn't, he tries to make a big deal of it. And he did it before the Super Cup against Atletico Madrid. He was like, well, you know, we can win 6 trophies this year where Mourinho only won 3. And of course, he didn't win it. And then before this game, he made absolutely certain that everyone knew that, well, Inter didn't win here last season. And guess what? They didn't again.
I'm just wondering how Benitez is reacting to the scrutiny of his tactics he's likely to get in Italy. Probably more so than here, because he seemed very touchy.
I do think he's between a bit of a rock and a hard place when it comes to tactics, because essentially his choice is do what Mourinho did and know that whatever happens you're going to be just copying Mourinho and not as good, or change it and then you're not going, as soon as it goes wrong, you're changing the tactics that won the treble. He hasn't, he wasn't allowed to sign anyone in the summer, which he played nice about. He smiled and gritted his teeth and didn't really complain about that too much. So now he's in this position where he's got exactly the same players, and he's made subtle tactical changes, but they're not necessarily coming off that well, because, for instance, he's moved Samueletto closer to goal, even though he's still playing wide, and told him he doesn't have to defend anymore. And then in the first half of the game last night, Christian Kivu basically turned round to him and said, look, if you don't tell these guys to start running, I'm leaving. That's his fullback saying, if you don't make these guys help me, I'm going to leave. So it's difficult, but at the same time, Eto's scoring a lot of goals. He's got 5 in 5 so far this season, and Diego Milito isn't. So you pander to the players who are getting the job done for you, don't you?
Interesting. They're now tied on top of the table with those soaring Eagles, Lazio, who had another victory yesterday. What was it? 1-0 away to Chievo, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, very impressive stuff under Eddie Reha. Zarate now back in the side after a little bit of a disciplinary freeze-out from the Lazio manager. Milan victorious. They've very much gone now with the defend and pump it long to Ibrahimovic line.
Well, whatever works, that's certainly what it looked like against Genoa, and it was it certainly worked against Genoa. It was a really, you know, nicely taken goal by Ibrahimovic, but such a classic Ibrahimovic goal. I'm going to take the ball with back to goal between two defenders, flick it over them, and then again get to it because I have size 46 feet, you could say, and flick it over the keeper. It was a wonderfully executed goal, and if he can keep doing that for them, I'm sure they'll be very happy.
All right, then. Other news, Fiorentina beat Parma, finally, and Napoli looked amazing in the final quarter of an hour of their game against Catania. Cesena, two brilliant goals by that fellow Edson Cavani.
Yeah, I like him. I think he's a good player. He's actually was never particularly prolific when he was during his time at Palermo. He's never been particularly prolific for Uruguay. That's the one thing he has been for Napoli this season, but I've always thought he's a great player with great movement. He's a very energetic player. Fits very nicely in what they try to do there, which is counter-attacking football.
Yeah, some great great goals there in that match. Let's finish off, though, with Juventus, who are going to be playing Man City on Thursday. And, boy, are they having a bipolar time of it. After winning last weekend, then they got defeated at home to, Palermo during the week, 3-0. Absolutely taken apart by the Sicilian side. And then they beat Cagliari, who were unbeaten coming into this, 4-2. Krasic is, I'm sorry to say it, the new Nedved.
I don't know. I think I wish we wouldn't have to call him the new Nedved. I wish we could just call him the first Krasic. He has
Goals from midfield.
He has blonde hair like Nedved.
Runs unstoppably.
I'm not sure if he's quite as natural a goal scorer. A couple of those
goals. He scored three on the weekend.
A couple of them took, knocks along the way, shall we say.
All right.
But he's a good player. What's interesting, actually, is that I think now it's three times this season teams have won 4-0 in Serie A. Certainly Inter, Milan and Juventus have all done it, and they all lost the next week. Because that's what Juventus did last weekend, obviously winning 4-0, lost midweek, but they're back on it again. So let's hope that four goals isn't the curse.
What do you think Man City are going to do to them? Or what are they going to do to Man City in the Europa League?
It'll be interesting, actually, because Mancini, obviously, the knock on him has been that he plays too defensively in big games and he doesn't come out against teams. I mean, Juventus are there to be had at the back, and they shouldn't be, because you think about what they did this summer. They brought in a manager who's known for his defensive football. They brought in an up-and-coming Italian centre-back in Bonucci to pair with Chiellini. You thought, OK, they're going to be solid, if nothing else. And they're totally the opposite. They're wonderful going forward at the moment and absolutely haphazard at the back. So,
do they not have the worst defensive record in Serie A?
I believe so, yeah.
Shocking, isn't it? Shocking. Many thanks then, anyway, to Paolo Mandini for that quick roundup on the Serie A. You should have heard the extended version. And before we conclude part two, let's just dial up Raphael Honigstein for a brief chat about the Bundesliga. Hi, Raphael. How nice to hear you.
Nice to hear you too.
Excellent. Mainz, the rise and rise of Mainz. 6 wins out of 6 now. And was this their biggest victory yet?
Well, certainly the biggest team they've beaten. Bayern Munich in the Allianz Arena during the Oktoberfest, where they supposedly are invincible, the Bavarians. They proved anything but. 2-1. A great, great win for Mainz, who did exactly what they said before the game, that they were not going to defend and sit deep, but they're going to go at Bayern, hassle them, play a pressing game, and they made them look very, very ordinary in the way, well worth their 2-1 win.
My word, are they this season's Hoffenheim, or what's the story with them?
They are this season's Hoffenheim, minus millions and millions of a wealthy benefactor that Hoffenheim enjoy, plus also a much, much cheaper team. They are only spending about €17 million on wages for the whole side. That's more or less what Bayern pay Frank Ribery and Arjen Robben not to play throughout most of the season. So it's really remarkable, and I think it's a great testament to both the manager, Thomas Tuchel, 37, but also the general manager there, Christian Heidel, who've bought really, really well and put together a team that can mix it and shake it with the best.
All right. Do you think they can last the course?
Well, I mean, Van Gaal afterwards was stunned, and he said, you know, these guys can win the championship if they would play like that. But at the same time, he said, I'm not quite sure they can keep playing this game throughout the season because it's so intense and it runs so much that Tuchel has been changing about five players every game throughout the last couple of weeks because he needed the others to rest. And there is a suspicion or a hope, I guess, from Bayern's point of view, that they can't keep it up once injuries will come in. But, you know, the way they've been playing so far with the perfect game plan for every single game, difficult to see them fall too deeply. I think that they're going to be better than last season when they finished ninth, which already was sensational by their standards. Maybe get into Europa League. I don't think they can go much further, though.
Rafa, I suppose we should have a word about Steve McClaren. His Wolfsburg side have won three in a row now, and they're now in the top six of the Bundesliga.
Yeah, he's turned around a little bit. Two wins, Grafite scored two goals again. These are games that they always should win with the squad that they have. They have a really good squad. And changing back to the system that the Wolfsburg player wanted and were familiar with, really a sort of a box standard 4-4-2 with Diamond in midfield, has made all the difference. Dzeko looks much happier with Grafite alongside him. Diego, of course, has freedom with three guys defending behind him most of the time or just carrying the balls towards him, and it works really well. And I think that they can still get into the Champions League. I think third spot is very much up for grabs this year because while Bayern are down in the middle of the table, the other teams haven't really shown any consistency either. You can't really say that Hamburg, Leverkusen, Bremen, Stuttgart, certainly not, who are bottom of the table, or Schalke have done enough to sort of stake a claim, so it's very much up for grabs this year.
But what about Dortmund? I mean, they've won five out of six. They've been, again, very impressive at the weekend.
Yeah, Dortmund looked brilliant, it must be said. Sort of a little bit like Mainz, which is, of course, not surprising because Jurgen Klopp used to be at Mainz and sort of started their way of playing there with that intensive game. And he's playing a similar style at Dortmund with better players. So the combination of really hard work, lots of running, great technical ability from the likes of Shinji Kagawa, the young Japanese player we've mentioned, but also Kevin Grosskreutz, who scored two goals for Germany, Mario Götze. These are guys that are really pushing very, very hard for the German national team. They've just got a winning package there, and you know they're not overly concerned with the Europa League, you feel, and they've got the momentum. But you know, we'll see a little bit more, not a little bit more, when they host Bayern on Saturday. So it's a really big game coming up.
Thank you very much, Raphael Honigstein. Of course, German sides involved in the Champions League. Bayern are away at Basel. Werder will be taking on Inter at the San Siro. And Schalke are at home to Benfica. 300 posts before the message board closed. Well, there's only room for one right now. Rich Alchemy says, having Bebe and Nani in the same team is a headline writer's dream. Nice little comment there. Excellent. That's it for part two. Onwards and upwards to part three, listeners. Part three, Barney.
Part three, I'm looking forward to that.
Are you?
Yeah.
What are you looking forward to most about part three?
I'm looking forward to finding out exactly what bits of the universe we haven't yet covered in parts.
You say that, but there'll be merry posters complaining about the fact that we've eschewed comment on their team, which we have done in the past and we were wrong. Frankly, we were wrong to not cover in greater depth Newcastle's famous victory over Stamford Bridge. I do apologise on behalf of the people responsible, producer Ben mainly, and others. They know who they are. I tried to stop them, but anyway. Paul Gascoigne, manager of Garforth Town. I have to say, well, here's a quote from Simon Clifford, who is a lovely chap. He's I thought he was lovely. I used to work with him a bit, and I thought he was a lovely chap, and I like his way of thinking. But then, yeah. Anyway, he says, this is not a publicity stunt. When we signed Socrates and Kareka to non-league Garford Town, that was. But everyone says they love Paul. Nobody does anything about it. Well, now he has. And let's just hope this works out.
Well, absolutely. If it does happen, I mean, we've tried putting calls in to Simon and Gazza this morning, and they're not answering. But I was there when Gazza took over at Kettering, and I did his first game, and they won, and you know, and I said his pale blue eyes were alive again for the first time in years. And he spoke to us afterwards, and he said, you know,
it's a line worth repeating, that wasn't it?
No, not really.
A direct quote from your match report.
No, he said he had 2 hours sleep. He said he arrived at the ground at 10 a.m., had a cigarette, then another one, and then another one. I came in early because I wanted to feel the place. But he said he phoned up his team that Friday night because he hadn't actually met any of them. And he said a couple of them didn't believe me and put the phone down. I told them, it's Gazaman, your new gaffer, but they weren't having it.
Right.
I really hope if he does join, he has a lot of success. My abiding memory of that, there was Gazza speaking to us, his fingers sort of twitching nervously as he puffed another cigarette. And I just hope all is well with him.
Yes. Well, indeed so. Anyway, in the meantime, there's plenty of Premier League news from the weekend that we never covered. We haven't got time for all of it now, so let's just mention the fact that Everton are now bottom of the table after that draw at Fulham. Craig, actually, you're going to say something, aren't you? Go on.
Apparently Everton played better than they have done for most of the season against Fulham and created a few chances, and it seems that it was a bit of bad luck that prevented them actually winning that game. And I personally think they'll be fine this season. I know they've had a dreadful start, but I think they've got enough quality there. They've got players coming back from injury now as well. And with Mikel Arteta in the middle of midfield, I think they've got enough to stay up.
People talk about the need for a striker. I think it's illustrated by this stat. Only Chelsea and Arsenal have had more shots this season, according to Opta, than Everton.
Really? Well, that is curious. Gerard Houllier got a win on his Premier League debut with Aston Villa against Wolves. Stoke won to move out of the relegation zone. West Ham beat Spurs. And Barney Rona, you were there.
Yeah, it was a really good game, actually. It was really it was a lot of chances on both sides. Harry Redknapp described it as being like a basketball game, which I think he meant was just very end-to-end. But West Ham... looking slightly more powerful physically,
yeah.
A taller team, and they terrorised the Spurs defence.
Without being funny, I wondered if that's what he was referring to with this basketball analogy, the fact that they put out a very, very tall side.
Well, certainly
they,
up front, they've got the new attacking partnership of Obinna and Piquion, with Cole on the bench, which must have come as a bit of a shock, but the three of them are sort of big, strong, hard-working players, and Spurs had no answer. They've got lots of injuries in defence, but they look a bit overstretched. They don't look like a team who's going to be able to fight on two fronts at the moment.
All right. Well, with all those centre-backs out, West Ham, they're two straight wins in League and Cup.
Yeah, and Avram Grant had talked about sort of beginning of an era, and he has had really not very much time there. And I think they'll be fine, actually. I think Grant is actually quite a good manager. I think he's quite underrated in this country. I think he's actually quite decent. He knows how to organise a team. And I think West Ham will be absolutely fine.
Oh, you see, I'm confused now, because I just got my head around the fact that it turned out he was complete charlatan. And now it turns out he's actually quite good.
Well, who said he was a charlatan?
Whoever was in last week, they'd kind of sold me on the fact that...
Was that you? Sure.
No, both Rafa Honigstein and myself aren't convinced of his merits.
Right, well, there you go. Let's finish off today with an emotional Liverpool-Sunderland clash at Anfield. Is meltdown approaching for Roy Hodgson, first of all?
I don't think it's approaching yet, but...
Have you seen his face in the last week?
Yeah, you can smell crisis around Anfield at the moment. And
he looks like, I don't know, that Munch painting or something like that, or... I was talking with you, Sean, saying he's approaching Colonel Kurtz.
His face is getting more saggy, isn't it?
He's
horrified look in his eyes.
Frightening. You know? He needs weeks of sleep and rest.
I've never heard Liverpool equated to the Belgian Congo in the 1950s.
Well, it is very much, heart of darkness.
It's almost that first goal that Liverpool scored is almost... It kind of sums up the desperation at Anfield, that... Most teams, even on a Sunday, you wouldn't accept that as a goal. I mean, it was clear that Michael Turner was back heeling the ball for his goalkeeper.
All right,
to take
for anyone who didn't see it.
Yeah, for anyone who didn't see it, Stuart Atwell, who had a nightmare of a game anyway, he wasn't looking at the ball at the time that Michael Turner put the ball where the free kick was going to be taken from. And he must have got a shout from the goalkeeper behind him who said, I'm going to take this free kick. And he backheeled it and ran away forwards as if to go upfield and the free kick would be taken. And Fernando Torres, who people have questioned how sharp he is, he's still sharp of mind because he nicked the ball off him before the keeper even got out to take it, ran up to the goalkeeper, squared it to Dirk Kuyt, and Dirk Kuyt scored the goal. And it was an absolute farce of a goal, and it might be within the laws of the game.
It's Sunderland's farce. If the referee had blown the whistle, the next touch means the ball is live, no?
He hadn't blown the whistle, though.
He didn't blow the whistle?
I'm pretty sure he turned, wasn't even looking at the football, and apparently you don't have to blow the whistle for play to resume.
Right.
But he wasn't even looking at the ball, and it might be within the laws of the game, but it just stinks to me that that a goal can be given. That's
Is it not the case if the referee doesn't see the free kick being taken? he's got to stop the game. I mean, he's not watching.
But this is Stuart Atwell's naivety or whatever. He is incompetent. There was other occasions in the game where he got decisions wrong as well. And Steven Gerrard could have easily been sent off for the
elbow. We'll come on to that in a second. But mentioning Stuart Atwell, this shouldn't even have been a free kick in the first place.
No.
It was bizarre. Titus Bramble came in on...
Morelles.
And... why did he give a free kick to Morelles? Why did he give a free kick against Morelles?
The only thing I can think is Morelles was in front of Bramble. Bramble seemed to go underneath him trying to get the ball. And Morelles' feet were quite high near Bramble's face by the time Bramble was going down. So I presume he just maybe gave it for dangerous play or something. Right, but okay. it was farcical.
All right, Steven Gerrard then.
Yeah, he could have easily gone for it. I do think if there was an orange card, you'd award it because it was... It seemed like he was jumping for the ball and...
No.
You disagree? I thought he was jumping for the ball and his elbow was...
His feet never left the ground. It was very much a ground-based action. And there were two players, as I recall, involved in challenging for the ball. Mm. And Gerrard introduced himself elbow first into the melee and connected straight with the opposition player's face. Not the first time he's done this.
He didn't seem to swing his elbow. He seemed to jump and his elbows went straight up.
No, he just goes straight in with his elbow on his face, I think. Mm. But my recollection might be clouded by my... A recollection of last season when Gerrard was extremely
all those CCTV pictures of the powder blue jumper and the studio incident, which a similar motion.
Can I just make a point about Liverpool's formation as well? That Hodgson he went out there and I was talking to Sachin Nakrani downstairs who did the match report on the game. We're both unsure of what formation he was playing. Some people said it was a 4-4-2. Some people said 4-5-1. It seemed that you had a keeper, four defenders, and Torres, who was up front. And in the middle, there was Poulsen, who was holding. But he seemed to give Cole, Kaut, Gerrard and Morelles license to play almost in free roles. Now, for the first 7 minutes, that seemed to be working. Liverpool were passing the ball around very well. But then Konchesky was injured and had to go off, and Agger replaced him. He was a centre-back on the left. So Konchesky and Johnson were supposed to be the players who brought the width to the team. When Agger came on, that dissipated. And the four players then behind Torres, because they're all midfielders, were inclined to come back at every opportunity. So I do think not having a second striker at Liverpool is a huge problem. They only started playing again when Ungod came on alongside Torres, and players were staying further up the field, and that's when Liverpool attacked better. But I just think having too many midfielders on the pitch just means that you're going to play more defensive football. Let's not forget Sunderland here, by the way. Sunderland brought the best team I've seen at Anfield in a long time to end, really went for it. Darren Bent was very impressive, and Onuwa, I can't pronounce that. His ball in for Darren Bent's second goal was absolutely perfect.
Barney, tell us a little bit about Darren Bent.
Oh, he's an English goal machine.
Mm.
He's scored a lot of goals. You know, since 2005, he's second only to Wayne Rooney in English goal scorers, ahead of Frank Lampard and miles ahead of Crouch and a bit ahead of Defoe. And he's one of those players. He's a great club player. It's quite interesting to have players like that around at a time when the England team isn't perhaps the strongest. To have a player who can perform so well distinctly in club football, it's quite interesting.
And I mean, maybe he'll get a regular spot in the national.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he'll get a chance now. He scored a very good goal for England, and maybe his time has come. I think he's a really good player because he scores different kinds of goals. Scores headers, tap-ins, shots. He can play up front on his own. He's very mobile. He played like that for Charlton, was great. And his touch seems to disintegrate under pressure sometimes, and that hasn't been in his favour. But I think he's a very good footballer.
Spurs, they always used to say... he wasn't as good with his back to goal. And at the international level, you may have to play more like that. But I'm with Barney. I think I'm a big fan of Ben.
Nice one. Well, with that, that's where we come to the end of a pretty marathon Football Weekly. Many thanks to Paolo Bandini and Raphael Honigstein and Sid Lowe. They're in Spain here in the pod. Sean Ingle, Greg Ruffley and Barney Roney, and, of course, producer Ben. Listeners will be back on Thursday rounding up a bumper crop of Champions League fixtures and looking forward to the weekend, so do try and join us for that. For now, though, from all of us here, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.